Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin here with your Wake Up Call all the way from Southeast Asia. And the date of transmission is the 11th of September, 2015. Well, I'm going to talk to you today about something a little bit different from our normal bailiwick here on the Wake Up Call. It's to do with concepts and ideas that have been held in the past, in history, and have been widely accepted by the society in which people lived, and which were then discredited in favour of the more logical and probably the more clearly understood reality. Things like, for example, the Earth being flat, which, as you know, was held as the truth for many centuries until it was disproven. So we're going to deal with such a theory today, and no prizes for guessing what I personally have in mind, because I don't want to get into any kind of polemic here on the show about that. But anyway, imagine that there was a new scientific theory that warns of an impending crisis and points to a way out. This theory quickly draws support from leading scientists, politicians, and celebrities around the world. Research is funded by distinguished philanthropies and carried out at prestigious universities. The crisis is reported frequently in the media. The science is taught in college and high school classrooms. Okay, I don't mean global warming. Let me put your minds at rest right now. I'm talking about another theory, which rose in prominence a century ago. Its supporters included Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Winston Churchill. It was approved by the Supreme Court Justices Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis, who ruled in its favour. The famous names who supported it included Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone, activist Margaret Sanger, botanist Luther Burbank, Leland Stanford, founder of Stanford University, the novelist H.G. Wells, the playwright George Bernard Shaw, and hundreds of others. Nobel Prize winners gave support. Research was backed by the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations. The Cold Springs Harbor Institute was built to carry out this research. But important work was also done at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins. Legislation to address the crisis was passed in states from New York to California. These efforts had the support of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association, and the National Research Council. It was said that if Jesus were alive, he would have supported this effort. All in all, the research, legislation, and molding of public opinion surrounding the theory went on for almost half a century. Those who opposed the theory were shouted down and called reactionary, blind to reality, or just plain ignorant. But in hindsight, what is surprising and so alarming is that so few people objected. Today, we know that this famous theory that gained so much support was actually pseudoscience. The crisis it claimed was non-existent. And the actions taken in the name of the theory were morally and criminally wrong. Unfortunately, they led to the deaths of millions of people. The theory was eugenics, and its history is so dreadful, and, to those who were caught up in it, so embarrassing, that it is now seldom discussed. But it's a story that should be well known to every citizen, so that its horrors are not repeated. The theory of eugenics postulated a crisis of the gene pool leading to the deterioration of the human race. The best human beings were not breeding as rapidly as the inferior ones, the foreigners, immigrants, Jews, degenerates, the unfit, and the feeble-minded. Francis Galton, a respected British scientist, first speculated about this area, but his ideas were taken far beyond anything he intended. They were adopted by science-minded Americans, as well as those who had no interest in science, but who were worried about the immigration of inferior races early in the 20th century. Dangerous human pests, who represented the rising tide of imbeciles and who were polluting the best of the human race. The eugenicists and the immigrationists joined forces to put a stop to this. The plan was to identify individuals who were feeble-minded. Jews were agreed to be largely feeble-minded, but so were many foreigners, as well as blacks. And the idea was to stop them from breeding by isolation in institutions or by sterilization. As Margaret Sanger said, and I quote, "Fostering the good for nothing at the expense of the good is an extreme cruelty. There is no greater curse to the posterity than that of bequeathing them an increasing population of imbeciles." End of quote. She spoke of the burden of caring for, quote unquote, "this dead weight of swarms of inferior citizens." Theodore Roosevelt said that, quote unquote, "Society has no business to permit degenerates to reproduce their kind." Luther Burbank, quote unquote, "Stop permitting criminals and weaklings to reproduce." George Bernard Shaw said that only eugenics could save mankind. There was overt racism in this movement, exemplified by texts such as "The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy" by American author Lothrop Stoddard. But at the time, racism was considered an unremarkable aspect of the effort to attain a marvelous goal, the improvement of humankind in the future. It was this avant-garde notion that attracted the most liberal and progressive minds of a generation. California was one of 29 American states to pass laws allowing sterilization, but it proved the most forward-looking and enthusiastic. More sterilizations were carried out in California than anywhere else in America. Eugenics research was funded by the Carnegie Foundation and later by the Rockefeller Foundation, which was so enthusiastic that even after the center of the eugenics effort moved to Germany and involved the gassing of individuals from mental institutions, the Rockefeller Foundation continued to finance German researchers at a very high level. The foundation was discreet about it, but they were still funding research in 1939, only months before the onset of World War II. Since the 1920s, American eugenicists had been jealous because the Germans had taken leadership of the movement away from them. The Germans were admirably progressive. They set up ordinary-looking houses where so-called mental defectives were brought and interviewed one at a time before being led into a back room, which was, in fact, a gas chamber. There, they were gassed with carbon monoxide and their bodies disposed of in a crematorium located on the property. Eventually, this program was expanded into a vast network of concentration camps located near railroad lines, enabling the efficient transport and of killing 10 million undesirables. After World War II, nobody was a eugenicist, and nobody had ever even admitted to having been a eugenicist. Biographers of the celebrated and the powerful did not dwell on the attractions of this philosophy to their subjects, and sometimes didn't mention it at all. Eugenics ceased to be a subject for college classrooms, although some argue that its ideas continue to have currency in disguised form. But in retrospect, three points stand out. First, despite the construction of Cold Springs Harbor Laboratory, despite the efforts of universities and the pleadings of lawyers, there was no scientific basis for eugenics. In fact, nobody at that time knew what a gene really was. The movement was able to proceed because it employed vague terms never rigorously defined. Feeble-mindedness could mean anything from poverty to illiteracy to epilepsy. Similarly, there was no clear definition of degenerate or unfit. Second, the eugenics movement was really a social program masquerading as a scientific one. What drove it was concern about immigration and racism and undesirable people moving into one's neighborhood or country. Once again, vague terminology helped conceal what was really going on. Third, and most distressing, the scientific establishment in both the United States and Germany did not mount any sustained protest. Quite the contrary. In Germany, scientists quickly fell into line with the program. Modern German researchers have gone back to review Nazi documents from the 1930s. They expected to find directives telling scientists what research should be done. But none were necessary. In the words of Uta Deichmann, quote, "Scientists, including those who are not members of the Nazi Party, helped to get funding for their work through their modified behavior and direct cooperation with the state." End of quote. Deichmann speaks of the, quote-unquote, active role of scientists themselves in regard to Nazi race policy, where research was aimed at confirming the racial doctrine. No external pressure can be documented. German scientists adjusted their research interests to the new policies, and those few who did not adjust disappeared. A second example of politicized science is quite different in character, but it exemplifies the hazard of government ideology controlling the work of science and of uncritical media promoting false concepts. Trofim Desinovich Lysenko was a self-promoting peasant who, it was said, solved the problem of fertilizing the fields without fertilizers and minerals. In 1928, he claimed to have invented a procedure called vernalization, by which seeds were moistened and chilled to enhance the later growth of crops. Lysenko's methods never faced a rigorous test, but his claim that his treated seeds passed on their characteristics to the next generation represented a revival of Lamarckian ideas at a time when the rest of the world was embracing Mendelian genetics. Joseph Stalin was drawn to Lamarckian ideas, which implied a future unbounded by hereditary constraints. He also wanted improved agricultural production. Lysenko promised both and became the darling of a Soviet media that was on the lookout for stories about clever peasants who had developed revolutionary procedures. Lysenko was portrayed as a genius, and he milked his celebrity for all it was worth. He was especially skillful at denouncing his opponents. He used questionnaires from farmers to prove that vernalization increased crop yields and thus avoided any direct tests. Carried on a wave of state-sponsored enthusiasm, his rise was rapid. By 1937, he was a member of the Supreme Soviet. By then, Lysenko and his theories dominated Russian biology. The result was famines that killed millions and purges that sent hundreds of dissenting Soviet scientists to the gulags or the firing squads. Lysenko was aggressive in attacking genetics, which was finally banned as bourgeois pseudoscience in 1948. There was never any basis for Lysenko's ideas, yet he controlled Soviet research for 30 years. Lysenkoism ended in the 1960s, but Russian biology still has not entirely recovered from that era. Now we are engaged in a great new theory that once again has drawn the support of politicians, scientists, and celebrities around the world. Once again, the theory is promoted by major foundations. Once again, the research is carried out at prestigious universities. Once again, legislation is passed and social programs are urged in its name. Once again, critics are few and harshly dealt with. Once again, the measures being urged have little basis in fact or science. Once again, groups with other agendas are hiding behind a movement that appears high-minded. Once again, claims of moral superiority are used to justify extreme actions. Once again, the fact that some people are hurt is shrugged off because an abstract cause is said to be greater than any human consequences. Once again, vague terms like sustainability and generational justice, terms that have no agreed definition, are employed in the service of a new crisis. The similarities are not superficial. And I do claim that open and frank discussion of the data and of the issues is being suppressed. Leading scientific journals have taken strong editorial positions. Under the circumstances, any scientist who has doubts understands clearly that they will be wise to mute their expression. One proof of this suppression is the fact that so many of the outspoken critics are retired professors. These people are no longer seeking grants and no longer have to face colleagues whose grant applications and career advancement may be jeopardized by their criticisms. In science, the old men are usually wrong. But in social matters, the old men are wise. They counsel caution, and in the end, they're often right. The past history of human belief is a cautionary tale. We have killed thousands of our fellow human beings because we believed they had signed a contract with the devil and had become witches. We still kill more than 1,000 people each year for witchcraft, In my view, there is only one hope for humankind to emerge from what Carl Sagan called the demon-haunted world of our past. That hope is science. But as Alston Chase put it, and I quote, "When the search for truth is confused with political advocacy, the pursuit of knowledge is reduced to the quest for power." End of quote. That is the danger we now face. And this is why the intermixing of science and politics is a bad combination with a bad history. We must remember the history and be certain that what we present to the world as knowledge is disinterested and honest. In October 1925, English mathematician Carl Pearson began publishing a multi-part series of groundbreaking articles in the Annals of Human Eugenics. The series was entitled "The Problem of Alien Immigration into Great Britain, Illustrated by an Examination of Russian and Polish Jewish Children." And it went on for hundreds of pages over several years. Pearson's article focused on, quote-unquote, "whether the intelligence of the alien Jewish children is closely correlated with their defective physique," and concluded, among many other things, that Jewish girls have less intelligence than Gentile girls. Unbelievable. Pearson was considered a well-respected scientist, yet his entire career is full of such work, analysing the various races and making scientific claims about their deficiencies, to the point that he openly advocated for war with inferior races. He wasn't alone. Some of the leading scientists in the world from the 18th through the early 20th century dedicated their careers to such nonsense. Dr. Samuel Morton's book, Crania Americana, for example, is a nearly 500-page phrenology tome which makes all sorts of bizarre assertions of various races based on the measurements of their skulls. This is what passed as science back then. And even senior policymakers, including the likes of Winston Churchill, believed in the findings. After all, the scientists said it was true, and they had a bunch of fancy equations, data, and mathematical models to back it all up. Today, it's revolting to think that anyone could possibly have believed such garbage. But at some point in the future, people are going to say the same thing about us. Only this time, instead of eugenics and phrenology, our faux pseudoscience is economics. Case in point, the US Federal Reserve recently published a paper entitled "When Does a Central Bank's Balance Sheet Require Fiscal Support?" Translation: how bad do things have to get at the Fed before they need to be bailed out by the federal government? Remember that the Federal Reserve is ultimately the issuer of the United States dollar. In fact, you'll notice when you look at your money, it says Federal Reserve Note on the face. And over the last several years, the Fed has engaged in the most extraordinary program of expanding its balance sheet. They've essentially conjured new dollars or notes out of thin air and given them to banks in exchange for all the toxic assets that blew up in 2008, along with trillions of dollars worth of US government debt. What remains for the Fed, the bank's net worth, is razor thin. At this point, it's less than 1.3% of its total assets. This is a laughably tiny margin of safety. It means that if the value of the trillions of dollars worth of assets that the Fed is holding happens to fall by just 1.3%, then the Fed will be bankrupt. 1.3% is nothing. Most people's investment portfolios go up and down more than that in a single day. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, pointed out that Treasury yields moved 40 basis points in a single day last October. So yes, this absolutely can happen. But the Fed isn't worried. In its latest paper, they say that while it is possible that their net worth could become negative, such a phenomenon would be, quote-unquote, temporary and would not create serious problems. What a convenient assumption. In other words, the issuing authority of the United States dollar and one of the largest financial institutions in the world thinks it's no big deal if it goes broke. How can they possibly justify such madness? Simple. They have pages and pages of complex mathematical models and differential equations to back it up. Funny thing, Carl Pearson and his colleagues had complex mathematical models too. And influential policymakers believed Pearson's dubious theories, in many cases actually waging war against inferior races. Today's policymakers believe modern economic pseudoscience as well. And they actually are implementing the ideas, like printing your way to prosperity. These are the people who have control over your livelihood. We're supposed to trust that they're good guys, that they're smart, responsible stewards of the financial system. And yet, they think it's perfectly fine if the issuing authority of the United States dollar is bankrupt.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's wake-up call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts, no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, in the last show, I spoke at some length about the ridiculous unemployment figures. I'm going to touch on this once again, very briefly, because it's vital for you to understand what's going on here, and a little affirmation can frankly do no harm. As you know, the unemployment figures released a few days ago left much to be desired right before entering Labor Day. Not many people can enjoy the labour part of the holiday, since those not in the labour force has hit another stunning record. The latest gloomy figures show that 94 million Americans are not in the labour force. This category added a stunning 261,000 people, while overall jobs added came in at a lackluster 173,000. When we dig into the unemployment figures, we find that many of the jobs being added are also coming in the form of low-wage jobs. The market is at last coming to the grim realization that something is fishy with how the employment figures are reported. America supposedly has the lowest unemployment rate in 7 years, yet somehow it now has 94 million Americans not in the labor force, with hundreds of thousands of people dropping out each month. Those findings Or rather, those finding work are largely in what one euphemistically calls McJobs, with low pay, no benefits, and job security that resembles the lifespan of a fly. The army of non-working Americans continues to grow. The unemployment rate is a tricky number, since it is derived by the total pool of potentially available workers. So if you continue shrinking the pool, the unemployment rate continues to look better, despite the reality that many are dropping out because they are unable to find work or are going into massive debt with going to college. We aren't counting kids or those unable to work here. This is coming from larger structural changes. The figures are insane. Let us break them down for you. Not in the labour force. Year over year increase, 1.8 million. Increase since December 2007, 14.9 million. Over this period, only 4 million new jobs have been created. Is it any surprise the unemployment rate is at a 7-year low, even though we just expanded those not in the labour force by 14.9 million? Then we have many older Americans becoming fully dependent on Social Security as their primary source of income and relying on a smaller employment base for support. These are issues that will continue to put a strain on the system, short of the market adding millions of new jobs. That would be the rosy scenario. Well, so far, that has yet to materialize. I think the big difference we have seen over the last decade or so is the proliferation of alternative sources of media. If it were not for the internet, people would be echoing the shallow drivel that comes out of the mainstream press. When in the past has the not in the labour force category ever been covered? Never. The media has become a shell of its former self and has lost a sizable portion of its power. We have a major crisis unfolding. We have millions of Americans saddled with $1.36 trillion in student debt. We have a large number of current workers employed by low-wage jobs that seem to be the top employment fields. On this past Labor Day, it matters that we actually count those that are in the labor force and those that are not. Numbers do matter. And when you have 94 million Americans not in the labour force, we have to dig deeper. All right, well, export prices in the US have declined the most since July 2009. Significant declines sweep nearly all categories of the import and export price report, pointing squarely to a deepening of cross-border deflationary pressures. Import prices fell 1.6% in August, slightly more than expected, while export prices fell 1.4%, which is substantially more than expected. The monthly drops for both are the steepest since the oil price rout of January. Petroleum pulled down the import side, but even when excluding petroleum, prices fell 0.4%. Export prices were hit by lower prices for industrial supplies, foods, feeds, beverages, and also agricultural products. And finished goods, whether on the import or export side, show a run of minus signs for both the monthly readings and the year-on-year readings. Year-on-year rates are severe, at minus 11.4% for total imports, which is the lowest since September 2009, and minus 7% for exports, which is the lowest since July 2009. China's manufacturers slashed prices at the fastest rate in 6 years in August, as commodity prices fell and demand cooled, signalling stubborn deflation risks in the economy and adding to expectations for further stimulus measures. The Producer Price Index, PPI, fell 5.9% in August from the same period last year, its 42nd consecutive month of decline and the biggest drop since the depths of the global financial crisis in late 2009. And that was according to data showed a week ago. Official and private factory surveys last week also showed manufacturers laid off workers at a faster rate last month as their order books shrank. It was not that long ago that hedge funds had massive bets on the value of the yen rising. China even took steps to stop hot money from flowing into the country. Hot money and then some is now going the other way. And by the way, please recall all the inflationists telling China to stockpile copper, lead and other commodities instead of holding US treasuries frequently labelled worthless certificates of confiscation. In retrospect, pro-cyclical stockpiling of commodities now looks foolish to nearly everyone. And, as you know, I have been consistently on the deflation side of the argument for years. Okay, well, I've been asked to say a few words about the refugee crisis, and I'm actually, to be honest with you, somewhat uncomfortable doing this because my knowledge of these matters is severely limited. But I will say this, or rather ask this. What do you do in Germany when you cannot speak German or English? Where exactly do you get a job? And what if you get stuck in Greece or Hungary along the way? Humanitarians demand Europe do more. But look at it this way. If Germany provided airlifts to all who wanted out, something on the order of 6.5 million displaced citizens, they would be takers, not the 800,000 Germany is willing to take. And it's reasonable to assume there would be another couple of million non-displaced takers as well. Simply put, the easier the European Union makes it on refugees to get out, the more takers there will be. Let's examine the origin of this massive mess. Please recall the mindless US overthrow of Saddam Hussein that totally destroyed Iraq and led to the rise of ISIS. The US also provided help to Al-Qaeda moderates in a foolish attempt to oust Syrian President Assad. Weapons instead ended up in the hands of ISIS. Russia and Iran both want to fight ISIS, but the US does not want that help because it wants to get rid of Assad. America learnt nothing in Iraq, nothing in Afghanistan, and nothing from the idiotic policy of giving weapons and aid to moderate extremists. The very heart of this mess is US meddling. Right, let's take a couple of emails, starting with one from Kevin Moran, who says as follows. And by the way, this is in answer to what I thought was a rather amusing email I sent out to my subscribers about how difficult it is to get New York waiters to put less cream cheese on the bagel. Mindset only works in the other direction, you see. Anyway, here's Kevin's response. Richard, nothing like a New York bagel. Had one this morning, straight out of the bagel shop oven. Cost $1. Just dipped in olive oil, no cream cheese. I last ordered a bagel with cream cheese about 30 years ago, but this was the secret then. Bagel with a schmear equals a lot of cream cheese. Bagel lightly buttered, or in this case, cream cheese. Language is also key. Don't really know about people's comprehension skills these days. Don't eat donuts, but I wouldn't even buy a cup of coffee in my local Dunkin' Donuts because they add the milk and cream. Their judgment in this critical area is not to be trusted. The other key is rent, not the cost of a few ounces of cream cheese. They need to pile it on to justify the high price. Gotta go now and have a cup of Keurig brewed coffee, 40 cents, and maybe even a second bagel, $1. Oh, that market is down, as it should be. Well, thank you, Kevin. Very enlightening. A nice addition to our email bag from you. Not often we hear from you these days. Anyway, another email from Greg. Democracy is a feedback mechanism. Imagine perfectly built Google car driving around without any problems. Now imagine someone disabling its sensors for political reasons and feeding data from a nearest furnace. It is easy to predict that Google car with confused computer will no longer be perfect, will crash or become disabled. That school district is no longer functional because its sensors had become disabled and replaced by corrupted data coming from elsewhere. Regards, Greg. Thank you, Greg. Important point there, not to be missed. Well, ordinary people everywhere are in grave danger because governments and their central banking branches have put the gamblers in charge of the economy. The Brussels-Frankfurt leaders are deathly afraid of a stampede towards the exits by the front-running gamblers. They've now turned Greece into an outright debtor's prison, extinguishing the last remnants of democratic self-rule and imposing debt obligations that will approach $500 billion when Greece's new bailout and existing massive ECB debts are reckoned. Greece's battered and still shrinking $200 billion economy, therefore, will either simply die or become an exploding debt bomb. When Greece finally defaults, it will trigger the demise of the euro, the European project, and the continent's rickety banking system, stuffed to the gills, as it is, with the unpayable debts of aging, sclerotic socialist economies. In the same way, the lunatic twosome of Abe and Kuroda in Japan have succeeded in putting the Japanese economy back into recession, even as they run the greatest sovereign buyback Ponzi in history. The Bank of Japan is buying up Japan's stupendous 1 quadrillion yen of public debt faster than new debt is being created, thereby pegging the 10-year Japanese government bond at a ridiculous 36 basis point yield and flushing Japan's domestic investors into a rampaging stock bubble, an accident waiting to happen. In nearby China, the statist fix gets more preposterous by the day. Having sent out $300 billion to buy unwanted stocks and the paddy wagons to arrest anyone even a tad too eager to sell, China's chief money printer told the G20 last week that China's $5 trillion stock market meltdown was over. But when the Shanghai market opened nearly 2% down on the next business day, the national team went berserk, hitting the office in a desperate effort to prove him right. On a dime, the red casino suddenly ripped to 3% higher by the market's close. So the gatekeepers of red capitalism now depend on a blunderbuss plunge protection team to keep the grim reaper at bay. with more retail stock account holders at 90 million than Communist Party members at 80 million and more separate trading accounts, 287 million, than the combined population of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Thailand at 267 million, a supreme irony has come to pass. Beijing's heirs of Mao's anti-capitalist revolution have no choice except to prop up the stock market in order to obfuscate the deflationary whirlwind blathering Mr. Deng's hothouse economy. Even then, the giant red elephant in the room is hard to hide. That's why capital is in full flight, as underscored by last week's disclosure that China's vaunted FX reserves dropped by $94 billion in August alone, notwithstanding a huge current account surplus. That's also why China's imports plunged by 14% and exports by nearly 6% last month, and why car sales have dropped sharply again in August. Indeed, flatlining industrial production, power consumption, and freight shipments all show an economy floundering at stall speed or worse. Well, after a summer of missed opportunities, poisoned rhetoric, and bitter recrimination, Spain faces what promises to be a very tumultuous autumn. On September the 27th, its largest economic region, Catalonia, will hold its most important elections since Spain's late dictator, Francisco Franco, passed away 40 years ago. If the pro-independence parties win a majority of seats in Catalonia's parliament, they have pledged to declare unilateral independence from Spain. As if that were not enough, in December the country will hold what could turn out to be its most tightly fought general election in decades. The inevitable result is increased fear and uncertainty. The same thing happened in Greece after Syriza's victory at the beginning of this year is now beginning to happen in Spain. The nation's debt is becoming more costly as jittery investors desperately look for other places to park their cash, at least until tensions die down. Despite the gathering economic fallout, political tensions in Spain continue to grow. A new poll showed that pro-independence candidates are on course for a majority in Catalonia's regional parliament before a Catalan election on September the 27th. It didn't take long for Madrid to hit back, this time with a barely veiled threat from the Ministry of Defence that a military intervention in Spain's northeastern province would not be needed, quote-unquote, as long as everybody fulfills their duties. At a time when the country's biggest economic region is threatening to sever the cord, plunging the country into a constitutional crisis of unprecedented dimensions, general elections loom that are likely to return either a desperately weak coalition government or no government at all. Well, here's an update on the horror of Greece's future. A survey by the Small Enterprises Institute of the Hellenic Confederation of Professionals, Craftsmen and Merchants shows that many of the country's very small enterprises believes that the returning recession and the capital controls are likely to finally put them out of business, with about 30% of them facing the threat of closure in the next 6 months. It is estimated that the number of enterprises in Greece will drop by about 63,000 in the next 6 months, and that the toll will be higher for very small companies. Indications that appeared in the second half of last year suggesting that the country was finally emerging from its recession have been eclipsed in the last couple of months. According to the study's baseline scenario, business closures will lead to some 138,000 people losing their jobs, including employers, the self-employed, and salary workers, of whom about 55,000 will be salary workers. In the first half of the year, total job losses in small and very small enterprises amounted to 25,000, of which 15,000 concerned salary workers. The marginal decline in the jobless rate came to 25% in May, according to the latest LSTAT figures, but it seems unlikely to be reproduced in the second half of the year. The survey showed that over 20% of enterprises consider it probable that they will have to lay off staff in the next 6 months. This rate is considerably greater, at 40.2%, among enterprises employing more than 5 people. 3 in every 7 businesses, or 43%, are facing difficulties in making salary payments, while 1 in every 4 reduced its employees' salaries during the first half of the year. Over 2 in 5 enterprises, 41.1%, say they are likely to cut salaries or working hours during the latter half of the year. Well, I really fear for the unwind of the global government finance bubble, the grand finale of a multi-decade period of serial bubbles. It's history's first systemic global bubble, encompassing the world's credit systems, securities markets, and monetary systems more generally. Excesses have engulfed the heart of money, and credit throughout both the developing and the developing world. Central banks of all stripes have printed trillions of so-called money, and trillions more have been created in the process of leveraging securities and other assets. This type of monetary inflation invariably causes destabilizing speculation, fraud, malfeasance, and wealth redistribution. It's fermented a geopolitical tinderbox. The awful, awful consequences have yet to follow, ladies and gentlemen. And with that, I shall conclude today's wake-up call. I hope you will be having a nice weekend. I'm sure the summer will stay strong for you, as it usually does for a few weeks after Labor Day. But in any event, have a good one. I'm Richard Martin. I'll be back on Monday, same time, same place. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.